Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
Welcome back. Now, science fiction fans around the world are mourning a great loss as one of the genre's most influential authors, Ray Bradbury, died this week. He was 91. Credited with elevating the science fiction genre to the hallowed status of literature, Bradbury's vivid spacescapes and his enduring, often eerily dystopian vision of the future still dominates the sci-fi lexicon today. For a remembrance of Bradbury's works, which include 1950s classics Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles, Monocle's Chloe Potter was joined earlier by Brooklyn-born author Rob Cutto, who originally met Bradbury in a rather eccentric Parisian bookstore. Chloe began by asking Rob about the first impression of the iconic author.
He had commandeered the front desk of Shakespeare & Company, and he was just sitting there surrounded by book lovers signing books and holding forth, as he loved to do in his egomaniacal but lovable fashion.
He's been described as sort of childlike in his enthusiasm, hasn't he?
Absolutely. I think that's a quality that all great artists or people who aspire to art must have, is that sense of childhood wonder. I think one foot always has to remain in the Garden of Eden if you're going to be trying to do that. And besides having that as a psychological quality, this was in 1980, but he was, you know, quite old even back then, and yet he was dressed as a 12-year-old American boy with these knee-high white socks, white sneakers, white tennis shorts, and a blue zip-up blazer. Despite his whatever it was, 250 pounds, he was really quite a character.
Yeah. Now, one of the most read authors of his generation, what do you think was his unique appeal? What made him so brilliant?
Well, to be quite honest, I don't think that 100 years from now, Ray Bradbury will be remembered as a great literary author. I think that there was a time there in the 1950s when science fiction was still relatively new, that he did something that no other science fiction writer did, which was to bring certain elements of high art and literature into what was basically considered a commercial genre at that point. Mm. A more human quality, the typical things you find in a great novel in terms of human interaction and emotion and things like that. And I think maybe going along with what we just said, there is something about his work that appeals to adolescents or people of a certain age. I don't think that, you know, if your thing is high literature, you're going to go back to him when you're 50 years old. But there's a spirit in Ray Bradbury that is just wonderful and unique, and that radiated from his personality as well. Even if you might not agree with some of his very far-fetched ideas or political opinions or whatever it was, you liked him because he was sort of like that eccentric uncle that you'd visit every now and then, who would just sit there and hold forth and connect with you on a human level. And I think that the reason that I connected with him so deeply was we both had a great love as outsiders for Paris. You know, there's a word in French, flâneur, which means to just wander aimlessly and sort of emotionally and psychologically interact with the city around you. And that's what we spoke about a lot in the course of that interview that we did. He spoke about the romance of places.
Yes.
And that's really my favorite quote from Ray, I think, when I had asked him when he first became intrigued with cities. And he said that it was from seeing the covers of sci-fi magazines, which were all architectural, and that we love sci-fi because it's architectural. And they wound up the quote by saying, we love the romance of places. And I think something in that line describes not only an essential thing about Paris, especially for an outsider, but something in the work itself, in his short stories itself. We enter those stories and we really experience this extraordinary and unique place that doesn't exist, you know. And in his case, it was a science fiction realm, and and we felt comfortable there somehow, you know, as well as terrified in the more dystopic stories that he wrote.
Yes, his faraway fantasy places were always anchored in a sort of familiar milieu, weren't they? But as you say, he was always more spiritual than techie, more spiritual and human than techie in his approach.
Absolutely.
And as such, he preferred his work to be described as fantasy, didn't he, rather than science fiction. But he did enjoy the way science fiction had a knack of coming true, didn't he?
Yes, well, there is a specific quote that answers that exactly. He said, "Science fiction is a depiction of the real. Fantasy is a depiction of the unreal." And he considered Fahrenheit 451 to be his only science fiction work. Now, that might be going a bit far, I don't know. But I think it exemplifies what he's trying to say there, whereas something like Martian Chronicles, you know, where there's a famous story in that book called There Will Come Soft Rains, which he wrote as a reaction to the first supernuclear warhead. And he told me, well, the scientists weren't quite sure whether the Earth would catch on fire that night. He said, you know, you're too young to remember that, but that was quite a night for us. And as a reaction to that, he wrote that story about a house that lives on after the people and talks to itself. Well, that's not really something that would happen. So he considered that to be more of a fantasy example of fantasy. I personally think the distinction is a bit fuzzy, but you know, it's interesting that he made that, or that was an important distinction for him to make in the course of his work.
He also said he didn't want to predict the future, but sometimes wanted to prevent it, didn't he? There was a slyly subversive, or not so slyly, subversive element to his work, wasn't there?
Oh, that's an excellent question, and I think that's a really interesting question, because especially in the 1950s and 60s, there was a very subversive element in his work. He did become, I would say, politically reactionary. By the end of his life, he was very, very right-wing in certain elements. But in the 50s and 60s, he went on protest against the Vietnam War. He wrote a story called The Pedestrian, which was a reaction to an event that happened in his life when him and his friend went walking through Los Angeles one day, and as you may know, there's many streets in Los Angeles with no sidewalks. People just get in their cars. And he was stopped by a police officer, and the cop said, "What are you doing?" And Ray said, "I'm putting one foot in front of the other." And the policeman didn't like that and said, "I want you to stop walking and go back home." And he said, "Officer, I promise I'll never walk again." And he went home and wrote a story about a man who is, you know, the year is like 2050, and he stopped for walking in the street because people only watch television now. And there isn't even a need for police officers in the street, and this robotic car stops him and ends up committing him to an insane asylum, you know?
Yeah.
At that time, imagine the 1950s in America, you know, what a stifling time that was, and he wrote that story as a reaction to that. As you're saying, well, this is also very prophetic, because look what's happened today. People are voluntarily zoning themselves out in front of monitors. You know, it's not like 1984 where you were forced to have a monitor in your house. You have one, you go out and buy one. And I think in many, many ways, the stories he wrote were prophetic in ways that he wouldn't have even thought of.
Now, there's an absolutely wonderful story about how Bradbury began writing, isn't there, involving a visit to a circus carnival when he was only 12. He did always seem to give the impression that his writing ability was a gift, and that it was fairly effortless for him, and he just had to capture that ongoing theatre inside his head.
Yeah, you know, and that brings up two very interesting points. One which was, one of the first questions I asked him was about the process of writing. And I think, like anyone who's really tapping into a deep source, and writers will tell you this, painters are a little more secretive about what they do, but many, many writers will talk about you wake up, you have your coffee, and you listen. Because it's coming to you from whatever word you want to use, the unconscious, from another place. It's, you know, from a scientist would say it's your, you know, the other lobe of your brain is doing the work for you. But Ray knew that you had to wake up and wait and listen for that first sentence and catch it. That he wasn't the one writing, that it was coming through him. And I'm sorry, Claire. Well, I'm going off on a tangent. What was your initial question?
Oh, just about the story of what initially inspired him to write that trip to the circus carnival at 12.
Yes.
Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, and so that was one aspect of it. And the other one was Mr. Electro. And he met this carnival worker when he was a boy. I believe his mother took him to the carnival. And Mr. Electro was a carny who had an electrified sword, you know, and he touched Ray on the nose, and his hair stood on end. And he said to him, you know, you're going to live forever. And Ray's response was, you know, later on, that he would live forever through his work. Mm. You know, as Joseph Campbell once said, we die in our work. We die into our work. And I think he took that very seriously. But, you know, I think also what's wonderful about that story is that it explains a reality, which is that artists are deeply touched by this inexplicable power, and inevitably something happens externally to trigger it or to reflect it or inspire it, such as Mr. Electro. Something happens.
Now, Bradbury's particular vision of the future still influences science fiction today, and his influence went way beyond his books, didn't it, in his lifetime. Screenplays, scripts, you know, big films, even music.
Oh, absolutely. Like, there's that famous story, you know, that the man who wrote Rocket Man for Elton John, in fact, did take that from a short story that Ray had written. Again, as you mentioned before, that personal element that he introduced to science fiction beyond all the techie stuff, the Rocket Man story is told from the child's perspective because his astronaut father has to leave, you know, and the father has mixed feelings about leaving the family in order to go off and do his job. I think more importantly, from an artistic point of view, probably the most important cinematic inspiration was when François Truffaut adapted Fahrenheit 451 in 1966. Again, it was that period in the 50s and 60s where people were looking to Ray as some kind of bridge between, you know, commercial fiction and high art. There's also the example in 1953 when he worked on John Huston's screenplay of Moby Dick, which was produced in the year I was born, 1956. Also in television, there's too many examples to mention. I mean, there were so many dozens and dozens of scripts and screenplays and things like that. The one with my favorite title was the title he stole from Walt Whitman, I Sing the Body Electric, which was the 100th episode of The Twilight Zone.
And that was Monocle's Chloe Potter speaking earlier with Rob Coteau. You're listening to The Globalist. Headlines are next.